is soy.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Back in the olden days, when high school students used their senior year and their senior year grades to apply to college, most top scholars would, at this time of year, in early November, be flipping through the glossy pictures of the college brochures, comparing the color of the ivy at UNC to the pictures of the intimate seminars at Stanford, and wondering where to go. That was then. That was before the early decision boom of the 1980s. These days, parents and students start the college rush much earlier, planning in freshman year and then taking the fateful plunge and committing to a college as early as age 16 or 17. So when the presidents of Yale and Stanford announced this week that they are changing course away from early decision, they signal that there could be a substantial change coming in the anxiety-inducing admissions process. Next year, these two schools will adopt what they call early action programs. More than a semantic shift, though, the change allows students to pursue other institutions, to explore financial aid options, and make their final commitment later on in the spring instead of saying yes so early in the year. Now, Connection listeners, if you're a parent or a student applying this year, you know the tension involved. And for those of you who are accepted earlier, there's relief as well. If early decision disappears, is it a good thing? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us on the program today, the president of Yale University, Richard Levin, and the Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent, James Fallows, who's done perhaps the most in-depth research on the up and downsides of the early decision. I'm thinking this is something like a Connection alumni reunion, because the two of you were with us almost a year ago talking about this very thing. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Mr. Levin, can I call you Rick?
Sure.
Rick, last year you were talking about this as president of Yale, saying that you kind of wanted to get a national conversation going. Did you succeed in doing that?
I think so, very much. We've had a great response to my statements last year, and that partly impelled the decision to go forward with the change.
And was there a lot of people saying, no, no, stay with early decision, or in this national conversation were most people saying that you're doing the right thing?
The communications directly to me and to Yale were overwhelmingly on the side of change. There were, of course, some communications from the happy recipients of affirmative answers under the old system, but those might have been expected, and I would say overwhelming majority favored a change. And certainly the editorial support in some of the nation's major newspapers was also very heartening. All of this suggested to me that what I said last December had really touched a nerve and hit, in a sense, right on the mark. People were feeling the system created too much pressure and put high school students in too stressful a situation.
James Fallows, at the end of the feature that you wrote, you said that one approach might be to take 10 of the most selective American colleges, among them Yale and Stanford, and impose a moratorium or get them to agree on a moratorium. Do you get a sense that this may be the beginning of that?
Oh, very much so. And I think it's important to be clear about how important and valuable a thing it is that President Levin's done at Yale, followed by Stanford's move, because you know, in the long view of history, even the medium view of history, clearly these binding early decision programs are going to go away. And the reason is fundamentally that they are so unfair. They give a clear advantage in admission to the most attractive colleges to students who don't need to worry about what the financial aid offers will be. And just, you know, they're at odds with everything else that elite colleges have done in the last 25 years to try to broaden their draw. And so by President Levin first opening the discussion a year ago and now saying that even if it will be inconvenient for Yale in certain ways, it's actually going to change the program. I think you do see a domino, a very important domino being pushed over.
But Princeton and Brown and Penn have already said they're not going to change their early decision practice. And in fact, Penn figures prominently in your own research as one university that says it early decision is raise the caliber of the students and improve the whole admission process from their perspective.
Well, it's certainly true that for certain participants in this process, the binding early plans have been advantageous. If you are a student at one of these sort of elite high schools, public or private, you know, who knows the system, you can get preferential access to admissions. And for certain colleges, notably Penn and Columbia and some others, it's been a way to sort of work their way up the all-important rankings by locking in students early on. But for the system as a whole, it clearly has a negative effect in terms of the sort of the fairness and flexibility of the college application process, as President Levin has pointed out again and again. And so if you have essentially the commanding heights of the college system saying, we don't need to rely on this. So you have Harvard, MIT, Georgetown, which have not had this for a while. You now have Yale and Stanford saying, we don't need it. Over time, there is a kind of embarrassment effect for the colleges who say, oh, we still have to rely on this.
Rick Levin, last year, if my notes are accurate, over 15,000 students applied to get into Yale, and there were some 1,300 spots for freshmen. And last year, 40% of those students accepted were accepted by early decision. Is that accurate?
40% of those who came were accepted in the early process. That's right.
So this is a big shift for you in the way that your freshman class will be gathered next year, I should point out, not this year.
That's right. And there will be some risks and disadvantages for Yale as an institution in doing this. But I was just compelled, I think, by the overwhelming need to try to change the system. And Jim Fallows doesn't give himself enough credit. He wrote an article some months before my public statements last December that, in fact, urged the major institutions to take the lead, and even at some private disadvantage, and get out front and try to impel others to follow. And that's what we've done.
Tell me something, though, President. You're at Yale. I mean, you're not really going to take a big risk, whether there's early decision or not. Parents across the country would dearly love to have their children in your institution.
In the big picture, it's only a small risk, I agree. But in the admissions game, what we're doing is we're saying now we will admit people early and not be certain whether they come or not. So perhaps some fraction of those students will not end up enrolling at Yale. And we have that gives us less certainty about how we compose our freshman class. It may cause us to lose some students we'd very much like to have. Mm-hmm. But as I say, in the big picture, these are small matters compared to the liberating effect on high school seniors.
And Dick, I wonder if I could add on there, if I could. You know, in the American college system should not be a hierarchy because it has so many outstanding institutions. The admissions game does run, unfortunately, on a somewhat hierarchical basis. And I think as college counselors know, there is one particular risk that Yale has exposed itself to, which is in the head-to-head admissions competition with Harvard, more students admitted both places go to Harvard than to Yale. And Yale is saying that in that narrow competition, you know, whereas Yale sort of wins the trade-off against basically all other institutions, Yale saying it's going to expose itself to the risk that may be involved there for what that matters for the larger good of the system. And that's why it's even more important that Yale has taken the step than that Harvard has had a non-binding policy for a while. Because people could say, well, Harvard, you know, they're not really, they're losing only a few people that way.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Medford, Massachusetts. Jeannie's on the line. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. Listen, I just wanted to applaud these gentlemen for their work towards, you know, leaning against early admissions. As a parent of a senior in high school, he has been under so much stress to decide which school he would apply early to. And in fact,
so he was determined to apply early. Well, yes, and
maybe because of the feeling, and I don't know if this is true or not, that he would have a better chance to get in if he applied early. In other words, saying, this is the school I want to go to. And again, that may be a misconception on our part, but I must say he does go to a private school, and his college counselor tried to dissuade him and most of the kids
Where's he right now, Jeannie? Is he waiting to hear back from this school?
Yes, he applied early admission as of November 1st.
Right.
And he also applied early action to a few colleges at the same time. So if he does not get into this early admission, he will fall back on the early action. You know, if those don't work out, then he'll do regular admissions. So I do feel that it puts too much stress on the kids. They don't have the options that maybe they should have if they went with either early action or just regular admission. And I hope that other schools follow suit.
Jeannie, there's two things I want to pick up on from your call. First is a clarification, and Jim Fellows, maybe you can help me with this. I thought that a student was really only supposed to apply to one institution for early decision, early action. Am I wrong about that?
Well, it's my understanding that you can apply to one college for early action. I'm sorry, early decision,
right.
Meaning that that's binding.
Okay.
However, at the same time, you can apply to a few schools early action where you would pull those applications if, in fact, you got into, your first choice school.
Jim Fellows.
There are a whole variety of rules that different colleges have, and this is part of the morass, I think, President Levin's moves and similar things are trying to clear up. It's true, you can only apply to one binding program. The places that have non-binding programs have different policies about where else you can apply. And indeed, one possible downside or one sort of transition issue of moving away from the binding programs is the feeling that you might have sort of all the institutions being swamped by a lot of sort of lottery ticket, non-binding early applications. So that will need to be sorted out. But as far as I know, the only universal rule is only one binding application at a time.
Now, Rick Levin, go ahead.
I can amplify that, Dick. Prior to about 1995, virtually every school that had an early program, early decision, or early action only required the student to apply to only one place early.
Right.
There's been a transition over the last few years, and 3 or 4 years ago, the National Association of College Admissions Counselors made a policy, which doesn't necessarily bind on the institutions, but it did declare a policy that said you can only apply to one school early decision, but you can apply to multiple early action schools. Yale believes that is not a very good system, and in moving to early action, we have, like Stanford, announced that if you want to apply early action to us next year, you must commit that you're not applying anywhere else in the early round. We think that this will tend, again, actually to have a liberating effect. Students may signal their preference by applying early to Yale, but they don't. They're not committed to coming to Yale, but they shouldn't be flooding the system with applications to 4, 5, 6, 7 schools in the early round. That would just give more advantage to the students from the well-counseled private schools and selective public schools around the country. We think this will help diminish the frenzy, and I hope the system moves that direction where, you take one shot early and the rest of your applications you take late.
Jeannie, I sent my youngest daughter to university just this past year, and I'm hearing this maze that you're trying to make your way through. I feel for you. I hope all goes well for your son.
Well, I'm sure it will. He has a wonderful college counselor, and he's a pretty bright kid, and wherever he goes, he'll do well.
Thanks again for your call.
Thank you very much.
1-800-423-8255 to continue this conversation about the shift that's taking place in early decision. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about how, in fact, it does provide certain advantages and whether or not those advantages should exist, and how early decision also gives an edge to the better counseled, in many cases wealthier, students applying to college. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. We're talking about a decision announced this week by Yale and Stanford to back off on the restrictions imposed by their admissions policy of early decision, opening things up a little bit more for the students who would apply to those institutions, and talking about what the implications could be for other colleges in the United States. With me on the program, the president of Yale University, Rick Levin, and James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, who's done a lot of research on this particular issue. And I said just when we were going away, James, that there are implications for class in moving away from early decision. I wonder if I can just get you to explain how it is that the current policy favors kids who have that extra advantage.
Sure. And I think it's first worth establishing one point, which is that one sort of non-intuitive point to many listeners, I suspect, which is the big class divide in American society is between people who have any college education and none whatsoever. And there is a huge difference in life opportunities and income and every other sort of result that you find between people who have a college degree and those who don't. When you start looking at the fine gradations among colleges that matter so much to U.S. news and matter so much in bumper stickers and matter so much in alumni morale, they don't have that much demonstrable economic effect in the long run, surprisingly enough. If you look at the Fortune 500 or whatever, the people who dominated are from not from that prestigious of institutions. Mm-hmm. However, if you look at the elite institutions, which do have their important role in American life, the more you emphasize these binding early programs, the more sort of skewed their draw becomes. The fundamental chain of logic is this. It's been clearly demonstrated, we can go into this if you want, that there is an advantage at many, many schools if you apply under their binding early program. One study showed it could be worth as much as 100 points on the SAT, which is a lot. Second, if you apply in the binding programs, by definition, you can't care that much about financial aid because you can't compare different offers. You have to take what they give you. And then number three, the people who are best equipped to take advantage of these early programs are from the best public schools and the best suburban neighborhoods, the best connected private schools. So on the whole, you have a system designed to give advantage to those who are richer than average, whiter than average, more private school than average, more northeastern than average, and that's fine for those people, but it's not the direction higher education has gone since the 1960s.
So Rick Levin, does it free up a college like Yale to perhaps a wider range of students by not locking in close to half the freshman class in that early decision?
Absolutely, and that's one of the big advantages of moving away from the system. For Yale and most of our sister institutions in the Ivy League and other highly selective liberal arts colleges have, since the 1960s, had policies designed to be completely non-discriminatory with respect to a student's ability to pay for college. We practice what we call need-blind admissions. We don't look at the income of the family in deciding whether a student qualifies, and then only later do we award financial aid based strictly on financial need, not on merit. And that's true of many of the top schools in the country. We've done this as a tool to diversify our student bodies, and in particular to create the social mobility that has forever been a great virtue of this country, to create the opportunity for students from the poorest families, if they are intelligent and have leadership potential and have the kind of skills to succeed in life, give them the opportunity to come to the very best colleges. And one of the things that's happened with this pressure toward more and more people applying early, more and more strong candidates applying early, has been, I believe, to skew us away from that objective, so that we've seen, for example, the percentage of students on financial aid decline somewhat, modestly, in the last several years, and that is not something of which we're proud. I mean, it helps our budget, but it's not it's not consistent with our mission. Our mission suggests that we'll do better under this new regime.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to join our conversation. Let's bring Christoph Guttentag in. He's director of undergraduate admissions at Duke University. Hi, Christoph.
Good morning.
Now, Duke has, and I understand, plans to stick with early decision. Is that right?
Yes, we have an early decision program that we're comfortable with in how we are implementing it.
When you read in the paper and hear that Yale and Stanford and UNC and others are edging away from early decision, does it cause you to rethink that?
Well, I think every institution makes decisions that it thinks are at least to some degree in their own best interest. I think that the way we are using early decision now is one that I think is appropriate in that we limit the number, pretty severely limit the number of students who we bring in, who we admit through the early decision program. So,
what is the limit, Christoph?
This year we're planning on filling less than 30% of our class with early decision students.
Right.
So, and which means not only that 70% of the spots in the class are available, but also that probably over 85% of our admit offers will be regular decision admit offers. So we don't want a student to feel as if their only way to be admitted to Duke is to apply early decision. We love our regular decision applicants.
Jim Fellows, it's part of what we were talking about earlier, that there are just so many options around.
Yes, and there certainly are. And I wonder if I could ask Mr. Guttentag a question. It is true that institutions, in education and elsewhere, do things that are in their best interest. Would you not agree that what President Levin has decided for Yale is not in Yale's immediate interest? I mean, there are ways in which Yale will suffer because of this.
Sure, I agree. I think that there are ways that Yale will suffer, and I agree with that. At the same time, it's by limiting... By limiting a student who's applying early action to Yale to making that the only early application, while it's helping the student, it's also helping Yale. That is something that is protecting to a certain degree Yale's yield. I don't think that's inappropriate, but institutions make decisions that are both in the best interest of students and in their own best interest. And I think that they're making a wise choice.
Right, but I mean, it certainly locks in their yield less than their current policy does. And my point is simply that this is sort of a public-spirited decision as opposed to a self-interested one.
Well, I would agree with that. I just wouldn't want people to assume that there's no institutional benefit, or that it's only public-spirited. I mean, we all make decisions that have a multiple, a range of benefits across the board, and I think Yale and Stanford are taking one of several good steps in the right direction. I think if other colleges who decided to keep early decision limited the number of spots in the class that they're offering to early decision candidates, that would help as well.
Last question, Christoph. Do you think that if early decision actually began to disappear, that in the long run, parents of high school students, the students themselves, perhaps even the institutions might benefit by the fact there'd be no early decision anywhere?
Oh, I think in the long run, in terms of the very best interest for students and parents, the sort of binding early decision programs that a lot of schools use now would not be as beneficial as some alternative. So I agree that ultimately, if we all moved away from the current early decision plan, mm-hmm. that it would be beneficial.
Thanks for your time, Christoph.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Christoph Guttentag, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at Duke University. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Hopkinton, Massachusetts. And Barbara's on the line. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I do want to applaud the president of Yale for doing away with binding early decision. I have a son who graduated from high school in 2000, and he applied early decision to Dartmouth and got accepted. And I think that if he hadn't done early decision, he would have applied and got accepted to other schools and taken a more thorough look at other schools. He's not happy at Dartmouth. He actually took a year off. He is back there.
Yeah.
He's realized that that's a place for academic challenge for him, but he'll never like it there.
What went wrong, Barbara, in your view? Was it that Dartmouth had the prestige, and once he got early a decision there, he was locked in?
I think so. He hadn't really thought, he had looked at small northern New England liberal arts colleges, not really knowing what he wanted to do. His guidance counselor suggested if he really wanted to go to Dartmouth, that applying early decision, he may have a better chance of getting in. And financial aid was a consideration for us, but my husband's father had gone to Dartmouth, so we said, okay, go ahead and apply. He applied less than 10 days before their deadline. So if you can imagine what kind of chaos was in our house at that point.
I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, you don't. So I think that if he had applied to other schools and not applied early decision, he would have taken a more thorough look. He was our first one. We didn't know any better. I do have a second son who's a freshman at the University of Vermont.
Barbara, let's talk about the case of your first son, Ben. I want to hear from Rick Levin on this, because in part what Barbara's talking about, Rick, is taking something away from that marketing magic that universities exploit over students in making those that are hardest to get into perhaps the most desirable. An early decision is part of this in forcing kids to choose a place which may not be where they actually want to study.
I think that happens much too often. And I think what Barbara's described is the dynamic that occurs in very many cases, that the system, the high schools are eager to help the students, and they know, the high school counselors know from experience and from the statistics that Jim Fallows referred to, that the odds of getting in these early programs for a given student are somewhat higher than the odds of getting in later. And so students are very strongly urged, especially in more selective and especially Northeastern schools, to make an early choice. And students could benefit from more months of thinking about this.
Well, being six months older wouldn't hurt at that age.
Exactly. That's exactly. These are still very young young people, and they're immensely talented, and they really ought to take the time and decide in a leisurely way, in a reflective way, about where they want to go.
Barbara, thanks for your call. We're going to Boston now. John's joining us. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. A brief comment about the caller who just finished.
Yeah.
My daughter waited and applied everywhere, and it was no less of a panic.
No less stress, right?
Basically, I'm in favor of early decision for two reasons. First of all, while you don't get that extra 3 months, that doesn't mean you can't start earlier. These kids who are intelligent enough to go to Dartmouth or where my daughter went, which was Middlebury, certainly have the ability to figure out 3 months earlier where they want to go. And there is a real piece, if you know where you want to go, both for you and for helping to unclog the system by saying, I've made my decision, I'm satisfied with it, I want to go to Dartmouth, I want to go to Union, mm-hmm. I want to go to Skidmore. So I just don't think that the extra 3 months is all that much of an advantage. And I hope that the opportunity remains open. My son, who comes up to bat next year where he's a senior, wants to apply early admission and has a fairly good idea where he wants to go. And while we're obviously going to show him a lot of places between now and next fall when he has to commit to early decision, if he's decided, why not? It helps the schools, and it certainly will help with the last-minute applications and making sure the last draft of the essay is the right draft to attach to the application and all of that stuff that fouls up families every December.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Jim Fallows, the research that you poked through, and there was lots of it, seems to support some of what John is saying, that there are reasons for people taking advantage of early
decision.
There
is no doubt whatsoever that it's a plus for people who apply that way, and there are a certain number of people for whom it's the right match. And I guess I would say, just briefly in reply to his comments, yes, it's true that students can start earlier, but if they have to decide by the summer after their junior year, that's a large proportion of their high school career that is not involved in this decision. And having recently sent two children through the college application process myself, neither of whom, by the way, applied under a binding plan, you know, it's a lot of their life that happens in the senior year. Second, there's a kind of psychological additional twist to what a previous caller was saying, that the people who are accepted under binding plans often suffer a kind of buyer's remorse, as the caller was mentioning. The ones who are rejected under early plans have a terrible situation, because if you apply early, if you apply regular, you get results from a number of colleges, some good, some bad. If you apply early and you don't make it, you have about a six-month period or four-month period where you have this only one, you know, one verdict, which is negative. And I've seen that have a really harmful effect on these kids. So for certain kids, it's a benefit, but I still argue as a system, it's unfair.
Rick Levin, just a sense from you, if you can give us one, of what you see, what you hear from the high school guidance counselors in light of this, whether or not on balance, certainly perhaps not with John's case, but on balance, that extra time makes a difference or not.
Oh, I think many high school counselors, most that I've heard from, really do think that if the whole system could move away from binding early decision, it would be an improvement. And, you know, our hope is that the actions that we took and that Stanford took will do, as you were suggesting to the person from Duke, begin to create some momentum and some pressure and some sense that, you know, so every school ought to follow suit and do what is better for the students.
Jim Fallows, you know this better than I do. Do you think it's likely to happen, certain to happen?
It's nothing is certain in our life, but it would seem to me that again, the early plans are so opposite in their effects to the modern course of higher education that sooner or later they're going to topple. And to end, you know, where we started, I think this is a very important and historic and publicly valuable step that Yale has taken, followed by Stanford, because it changes the circumstance in which Amherst, Duke, Williams, Princeton, others make their decisions. And over time, you know, I think we'll see how important this step was.
And Rick, just one final one from you. You, when you talked about this last year, let us know that there were some certain antitrust implications that mitigated against a whole bunch of universities doing it at the same time. Is that a genuine concern?
Well, I used to teach antitrust before I was president of Yale. My own view is there really aren't any adverse antitrust consequences, but I couldn't quite persuade the Justice Department of that. They thought we should have a formal business review if we were going to discuss this, let's say, in the Ivy League Council. And we decided not to pursue that course because we knew that we wouldn't get unanimity anyway. And we felt that ultimately that acting alone and hoping others would follow was the best course. And we were utterly surprised and totally delighted that Stanford followed within hours our decision.
Rick Levin?
Stanford was careful to note they'd made the choice earlier and only by coincidence announced it that day.
Right, I noticed that little distinction. Rick Levin, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Richard Levin, president of Yale University. Jim Fallows, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Jim Fallows, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. Now, Connection listeners, this is not the time that we normally say goodbye to our guest. We're ending this part of the program a little bit early. There's another big decision that's been taken today. The UN Security Council has unanimously approved a new resolution on Iraq. Stay tuned. We will talk about that when we come back after this break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up at noon on Here and Now, how the world's oil markets are reacting to the possibility.
Come, and thanks.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. A little bit of a format change here. We're following some breaking news in the U.S. conflict with Iraq a little bit earlier this morning. The U.N. Security Council unanimously approved a new resolution on Iraq. The text of the resolution, which was drafted by the United States and Britain, calls for Saddam Hussein to disarm or face, in quotes, serious consequences, language that has been widely interpreted to mean war. Speaking from the Rose Garden, just following the vote, President Bush described the resolution this way.
The resolution approved today presents the Iraqi regime with a test, a final test. Iraq must now, without delay or negotiations, fully disarm, welcome full inspections, and fundamentally change the approach it has taken for more than a decade.
President Bush reacting to the vote in that the UN Security Council a little bit earlier this morning. And with us on the program, Elizabeth Newfer, reporter for the Boston Globe. She's covering the United Nations and is particularly busy this morning. She's given us a couple of minutes of her time. Nancy Soderbergh's also with us. She's vice president of the International Crisis Group, former deputy U.S. ambassador to the UN Security Council. Elizabeth, let me start with you. Did the vote happen as it was expected today?
Yeah, I have to warn you, Dick, I'm only going to be able to give you a few minutes.
Go ahead.
People are exiting. I am standing at the Security Council floor. They're exiting and answering questions to the press as we chat on the phone. No, I would say this vote was something of a surprise. The council had hoped for unanimity, but no one had predicted unanimity. This now really does send a very resounding message to Saddam Hussein. It is interesting, as people spoke on the council floor this morning, however, to see the different ways in which they interpreted the resolution. America gave a much harder line description of one last chance to disarm or face force. Russia, one of the countries that's been critical, noted that, in fact, well, we're delighted that we have gotten assurances that this is not a resolution about war.
Elizabeth, just the point about unanimity, we need to be more specific. That includes a vote from Syria supporting this. That seems to be the news in here.
Well, yes, it is. No one had expected Syria to embrace this. But again, Syria, like Russia and some of the others in the council, repeated again several times on the security floor that they had received assurances from the United States and from Great Britain, the co-sponsors of this resolution, that this was an effort to achieve peaceful disarmament, not war. Obviously, you know, that was the determining point.
Elizabeth, I know that you're in a hurry, and I want to thank you for taking just a couple of minutes to help us
Thanks,
out with
Dick.
This.
Got to run.
Okay, bye-bye. Elizabeth Newford, she's a reporter with the Boston Globe and is in the process of following the story at the United Nations, where there's been unanimous approval for a resolution that sends weapons inspectors back into Iraq. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, if you'd like to join us with a comment on this. We know it's a truncated little part of our program, but we thought it a worthwhile thing to try and cover this news as it's happening in New York. Nancy Soderberg is with us. Nancy, you've seen us through a couple of primers on what happens at the UN Security Council. That the vote was unanimous. Tell me what you think about that.
It's extraordinary. No one that I've spoken to over the last few months thought that there would be 15 yeses. Everyone assumed that at least Syria would abstain. They might vote no. They were expecting perhaps a Russian abstention and a Chinese abstention. And it's to Colin Powell and President Bush's credit that they got a unanimous vote. It's truly extraordinary. It's important for the implementation of this resolution to have a unanimous vote. The fact that there are all 15 members, and most importantly, the Arab nation representative Syria on the council supporting this resolution sends an unequivocal and very strong message to Saddam Hussein that the game is up. For the last 10 years, the coalition in the council has deteriorated, where French and Russian authorities were cutting deals for their development of their oil fields and sort of allowing Iraq to violate the inspections regimes with impunity. The game just changed.
Is it about the language, Nancy? Because if Syria says, yes, we can support this resolution, does the Syrian ambassador then go back to Damascus and the other Arab leaders and say, of course we could support this because we're able to point to the language of the resolution and say it definitely doesn't mean war, while at the same time we're hearing a different interpretation from others?
Well, the beauty of diplomacy is that you can put many different interpretations on words. What happened here is the Bush administration fundamentally changed its approach of last summer, where they were talking about war and regime change as the first option, to war as the last option. We're going to give one last chance to the inspections regime. It's really Colin Powell's first victory here. He's been rolled by the right wing in Washington repeatedly. Here, his line, we've got to do the inspections, let's try negotiations first, will put us in a much stronger position if, after we've gone through all this, Saddam Hussein is dumb enough to still violate these resolutions. We will have much stronger international support for going into Iraq, which they will need. So it's a smart tactic that's paid off.
I'm looking at one of the pages in the resolution right now, Nancy, and it's talking about the weapons inspectors. I'll skip the acronyms, but I mean, it's saying that these folks will have unrestricted rights of entry into and out of Iraq, the right to free, unrestricted, and immediate movement to and from inspection sites, and the right to inspect any sites and buildings, yada, 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 and unrestricted access to presidential sites equal to that at other sites, right, notwithstanding all the provisions. Now, that either means that the weapons inspection is going to work, or it means the whole thing's going to be over in very short order as soon as Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard says, no, you can't go in there.
Right. And I think when there's a first confrontation over a palace or something else, a site of concern, the Bush administration will face a decision of whether to militarily take that site out or to go through regime change. My guess is that they will start out with a roving hit squad against any site of concern before going to regime change, but we'll have to see. This is a very tight timetable that they've set out. The Iraqis have a week to agree to this resolution. They have another 30 days to send a comprehensive report to the UN saying, fessing up to everything that they have. The inspectors go in within 45 days, and then within 60 days, so by next February, they'll be reporting back to the council on whether or not the Iraqis have fully complied.
Nancy, can I stop you there? I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. When you say a week and then a month and then 45 days and then 60 days, are these contiguous? You're not saying that they overlap, are you?
No, they follow one another.
Right.
And so we're looking at February as sort of the end of the 60-day period. But it's a very tight timetable, and I think the indications from Baghdad are that they will accept the resolution within the week. So the first test will really come 30 days after that, when they have to report, and whether or not we have a pretty good idea of what's going on in Iraq, and we'll be able to tell fairly quickly whether it's an honest effort from the Iraqi regime. But I think that stepping back from this resolution, I think the unanimous vote today in the council makes war in Iraq less likely because for the first time
less
in
likely,
a decade,
you said.
Less likely because for the first time in a decade, the international community and the Arab world represented by Syria on the council is sending a very tough message to Saddam Hussein saying your game of cat and mouse, lying and cheating is over. And there's no doubt that you'll face military action if you don't comply. And the fact that Russia and France and the Arab world are sending that message to Saddam really does give one decent chance to Saddam Hussein to finally comply. Now, no one's betting that Saddam's smart enough to actually comply. He's made one mistake after another, miscalculated grossly throughout his time in office about the will of the international community. But it increases the chance of avoiding war. So the war is less likely today than it was yesterday.
Connection listeners, your sense of what the unanimous resolution means, vote taken earlier today in New York at the UN Security Council, the fact that it paints Iraqi President Saddam Hussein into a very, very small corner in terms of who's standing with him, who's standing against him, and what comes next. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to know what your reaction is. Certainly the President of the United States wasted no time in stepping into the Rose Garden and up to the microphones to give his reaction to the decision.
America will be making only one determination. Is Iraq meeting the terms of the Security Council resolution or not? The United States has agreed to discuss any material breach with the Security Council, but without jeopardizing our freedom of action to defend our country. If Iraq fails to fully comply, the United States and other nations will disarm Saddam Hussein.
President Bush speaking just a few minutes ago in the Rose Garden in response to the UN Security Council unanimous vote earlier this morning that the weapons inspectors will be on their way into Iraq. Lake Forest, North Carolina is with us. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi.
Your thoughts here. Do you think that the war is more or less likely?
I'm of the opinion that it's more likely than less likely because of this. I think Saddam Hussein has proved time and time again that that the international community is not going to tell him what to do. I think the minute inspectors go into Iraq, they're going to be stymied by his troops.
He had some allies in 1990 and 1991. He was sort of able to cozy up to a few of the friendly Arab nations and say, you know, I'm not alone on this, though it looks this time, David, that he's a little bit more isolated.
I think that isolation is going to make him act even more aggressively.
And more dangerously?
I do.
Nancy Soderberg, Vice President of the International Crisis Groups, on the line with us from New York. Nancy, what about that idea?
Well, I think David's right, and the chances of Saddam doing the right thing here are very, very slim. And if you look at history here, no one's betting on him. But I think the resolution gives him a better chance of actually complying than without the resolution. Had we not had the resolution, there'd be less pressure on him to do so. So it does give him one last chance. I share the caller David's suspicion that he's very unlikely to do it. But it does. President Bush did the right thing on trying to go this route and giving them one more chance. And I have to say the other factor here, I think, in addition to the war on terrorism and the isolation that now exists of Saddam Hussein in this very different environment, President Bush's strong victory in the elections on Tuesday does definitely strengthen his hand internationally, and I think contributed to the unanimous vote that we had here. So a lot of factors are lining up that could perhaps bring this to a successful conclusion without having to take military action. But I would say the, you know, 80-20% that it's 80% likely that we'll end up having to take military action, but the 20% got bigger overnight.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Nancy, why is it that you say the midterm elections changed something here? Changed it in the view of the White House, the Pentagon, or changed the power of the president in the view of other people, at the other nations at the UN?
Well, it was a stunning victory by President Bush in the elections. He bucked historical trends, the first president since Roosevelt to gain seats in a midterm election, strengthens his hands internationally, and I think helped him show the world that he's got the full support of the Congress, the Pentagon, the American people in confronting Saddam Hussein, and that helps send the strong message to Iraq that there's no iota of doubt that he will take military action should Saddam Hussein fail to comply.
Let's hear from Prime Minister Tony Blair of Great Britain, who's also just recently reacted to the decision at the Security Council.
Everyone now accepts that if there is a default by Saddam, the international community must act to enforce its will. Failure to do so would mean having stated our clear demand, we lack the will to enforce it.
Tony Blair speaking moments ago in response to the decision taken earlier this morning at the UN Security Council, a unanimous vote, surprisingly, unanimous vote there at the Security Council supporting the resolution. Nancy Soderbergh, one last little bit of direction from you. You gave us a rundown of days and weeks to come. What happens now?
Well, the action goes to Baghdad for the next week, and the Iraqis have a week to accept this resolution. I'm sure that there will be numerous discussions with him over the weekend. There's an Arab summit on Monday, which the Syrians tried to delay this vote until after that meeting, which the Bush administration rightly rejected. It would have just slowed things down. So we'll wait 1 week from today. We'll probably get a letter from the foreign minister of Iraq to Kofi Annan saying we accept these terms, and then things go silent for another month until we get a report from Saddam, hopefully fessing up to what he has. And then the real difficult part begins. It is not going to be easy to have the inspectors go in and have unfettered access. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that Saddam Hussein will do his level best to thwart their will, and we'll have to see what happens. One thing to remember is the words quick and the UN do not go together.
But
so things always take longer with the UN.
I hear a clock
involved.
Ticking, though. I hear a clock ticking. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Nancy Soderbergh, Vice President of the International Crisis Group and a former Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN Security Council. At the beginning of this little segment from New York, we also heard from Elizabeth Newfer, who's a reporter for the Boston Globe covering the UN. More details on this throughout the day on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.